Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
A South African judge grants an appeal in the Oscar Pistorius case. Explosions rock a market in Kano, Nigeria. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. A South African judge has granted prosecutors an appeal of the culpable homicide verdict against athlete Oscar Pistorius. That action clears the way for them to seek a murder conviction in the country's Supreme Court. Judge Tokozile Masipa announced her decision today.
In respect of the application in terms of Section 319, I am satisfied that the points raised by the applicant in respect of Count 1 are indeed questions of law.
She originally ruled in September that prosecutors gave only circumstantial evidence that Pistorius was guilty of premeditated murder when he fatally shot his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, and handed down a lesser conviction of culpable homicide. Two explosions have hit a marketplace in the Nigerian city of Kano. Initial reports say two female suicide bombers set off the blasts today at the Kantin Quarry Market. At least four people are reported dead, with several others injured. As expected, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has named Emmerson Mnangagwa as his vice president. That puts the former justice minister in line to succeed the aging president. Mr. Mugabe announced the appointment at party headquarters. He also named a former diplomat to the largely symbolic post of second vice president. Inflation in South Africa was down slightly in November due to lower oil prices. The AFP report's official figures released today show the rate of inflation dropped to 5.8% last month. This is VOA News. Nigeria's opposition party is choosing a candidate to run next year against incumbent president Goodluck Jonathan. Delegates of the All Progressives Congress are meeting in Lagos, according to the AFP. The front-running candidates are believed to be ex-military ruler Muhammadu Buhari and former vice president Atiku Abubakar. Nigeria's presidential elections will be held February the 14th. The African Development Bank is giving Zimbabwe over $100 million to upgrade its infrastructure, according to a report by the AFP News Service. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa says the money will pay for improvements to water and power supply facilities. He said the specific projects include upgrading power generation, rehabilitating water and sanitation services, and repairing the Kariba Dam wall. In the wake of recent attacks by Al-Shabaab militants, Kenya's parliament is considering new security laws. The AFP quotes local media as saying the proposed laws include allowing police to hold terrorism suspects for a full year, increasing sentences for those convicted of terrorism offenses, and giving the government increased power to intercept communications. There is media opposition to a proposal that could result in journalists being sentenced up to 3 years in jail if their reports are found to, quoting now, undermine investigations or security operations relating to terrorism, end of quote. Those who use social media to praise or incite acts of terrorism could face up to 20 years in prison under the new proposals. Opposition lawmakers say they will oppose many of the proposals. The United States ambassador to Uganda has posted a speech on his embassy's website saying new anti-homosexuality legislation in Uganda will hurt the nation's economy. The AFP News Service quotes Scott DeLicia saying, quoting now, "Tourists changing their destinations, conferences are relocated, coffee buyers moved away from Ugandan brand, and more," end of quote. Ugandan lawmakers have said they would like to present their anti-homosexuality legislation before the Christmas holiday. The U.S. news magazine Time Today named the medics treating Ebola patients as its Persons of the Year. The magazine is honoring the medical professionals who have been caring for the victims of the deadly disease. The Associated Press reports that authorities in eastern Sierra Leone today initiated a two-week lockdown to halt the spread of Ebola. A local official says the lockdown will last until December 23rd in the Kono district. While people will be able to move within the district, no one will be allowed to enter or leave. Taking a brief look at market activities on Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes opened down. In Europe, stocks were mixed. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There's still 470,000 homicides around the world every year. This is actually a decrease from the year 2000 by 16%.
That's Dr. Etienne Krug of the World Health Organization with some of the results of a new global report on violence prevention. Details coming up.
Also in the news, two explosions have rocked a marketplace in Nigeria's second largest city, Kano.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, two explosions have rocked a marketplace in Nigeria's second largest city, Kano. Initial reports say two female suicide bombers set off the blasts this afternoon at the Kantin Kowari market. At least four people are reported dead, with several others injured. Militant group Boko Haram is suspected in a string of attacks around Kano, including a deadly attack on Kano's central mosque late last month.
Nigeria has turned to Russia to buy heavier weapons following a recent strain in relations with the United States. After the U.S. rejected a request for Cobra attack helicopters, Nigeria canceled a U.S. military training program linked to the fight against Boko Haram militants. Analysts now are weighing the effects of the arms deal with Russia. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Jennifer Cook of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies follows U.S.-Nigeria relations.
In the broad sense, I think the relationships are good and enduring. But at this particular moment, there is a great deal of tension, particularly over the security relationship.
Cook is director of the CSIS's Africa program. Also watching developments in Nigeria is Ben Moores, senior analyst at the Defense and Security Analysis Organization, IHS Jane's 360.
I think the U.S. is still fully committed to supporting democracy in Nigeria in terms of a trading relationship, in terms of military equipment. I think it has changed somewhat with withdrawal of trainers, the training team from Nigeria.
Moore says there are several reasons why the U.S. would not sell Nigeria advanced weapons systems.
The advanced helicopters and fighter jets the U.S. has, they wouldn't want to go to Nigeria because that equipment could be passed on to a third party. And also selling fighter jets and attack helicopters to Nigeria doesn't perhaps solve the problem that Nigeria has when dealing with the insurgency. What you really need is a better motivated force, a more professional force, to deal with some of the social and cultural problems that exist in Nigeria.
Jennifer Cook says each side has a different perception of the situation.
Nigeria's perception that the U.S. is somehow abandoning Nigeria in its moment of need as it's threatened by Boko Haram and not providing the kind of security and military assistance that Nigeria feels it needs right now. For the United States, there's deep concern over Nigeria's response to Boko Haram, a very military-heavy response and one that has raised a lot of allegations about mass human rights abuses.
Rights groups say those abuses include the killing and detention of innocent civilians. Cook says the U.S. considers human rights an important issue in Nigeria.
The human rights standard is not just for moral reasons. It's that the U.S. has learned the hard way that human rights abuses and failing to engage communities really becomes a security setback over the long run as well.
But defense analyst Moore says U.S. concerns go beyond human rights when it comes to weapon sales and military training.
My understanding is that there were leaks or moles inside the Nigerian military who were leaking information to Boko Haram. They were leaking certain bits of information, training information, and perhaps information on the team itself.
Moores explains why Nigeria would turn to Russia for the types of weapons it could not get from the United States.
Russia is known to sell equipment at a relatively low cost. It's known to sell to pretty much anyone without any questions asked. It doesn't ask for any guarantees in terms of where the equipment go or how the equipment's used. There's no oversight. They don't have to sign up to any agreements. Not only that, but Russia's able to supply equipment relatively quickly and supply equipment that is fairly easy for less technically capable militaries to get that equipment into the front line at a relatively fast pace.
What's more, he says, Russia may give Nigeria a $1 billion line of credit to buy the weapons. The IHS Jane's analyst says Nigeria has a long wish list of military hardware, including jet trainers, light to medium fighter jets, some tactical transports, and ground attack helicopters. Moore says Nigeria has agreed to buy some Russian Mi-35s and Mi-17s.
These are fairly older aircraft and quite expensive to run, so that's probably why the Nigerians would have wanted to go to America first.
Moore also says Russia is now training Nigerian special forces. Cook, of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says the Nigeria-Russia relationship is one to watch.
Russia is willing. It has arms available to sell. It's willing to train. And it's early to tell, but one wonders if there's maybe a larger play by Russia in terms of winning new partners and poking a stick in the eye of the United States, for example. I think the Nigerian government right now is looking for help wherever it can get it.
Cook says it's easy to criticize Nigeria for alleged human rights abuses and corruption. However, she says it's important to understand the position that Nigeria is in.
I think there has to be this fundamental acknowledgement of what a difficult problem they're facing. When a group straps suicide bombs onto 14-year-olds or suicide bombers into mosques or dresses up as police and security forces and kidnaps hundreds of girls, the Nigerian government does not have the kind of training, the kind of equipment, the kind of command and control that the U.S. military has.
Cook says the U.S. should have a more positive and constructive dialogue with Nigeria. A lot of that, she says, has to do with diplomatic tone. The relationship between the U.S. and Nigeria has changed in another way, too. The U.S. used to buy a lot of Nigerian oil, but sales have dropped sharply as the United States has become much more energy independent. The U.S. itself has become a major exporter. Oil prices have plunged this year, and more declines are forecast for next year. That means a lot less money in Nigeria's coffers, as it does for Russia, also an oil exporter. Russia's economy has also been hit hard by economic sanctions due to its political and military moves against Ukraine. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Almost 1 year after a two-year-old boy in Guinea died of Ebola, the first victim in the West Africa epidemic, the World Health Organization reports the virus has killed more than 6,000 people in West Africa. And today, the head of the World Health Organization says the outbreak is still running ahead of efforts to contain the spread of the virus. WHO Director General Margaret Chan says there has been some improvement in efforts to control the epidemic, but large numbers of cases are still being reported. Some have been harshly critical of the WHO for taking too long to declare a health emergency in the first place. Chan says the whole world failed to recognize the scope of the problem in the beginning. Chan says, with hindsight, there should have been a much more robust response.
Also, the International Rescue Committee, IRC, is calling for a different kind of army to combat the spread of Ebola in West Africa. The organization is calling on community leadership to be placed at the center of the response, particularly in Liberia and Sierra Leone. They say community leaders must be listened to and empowered to initiate solutions that work best for their communities. Emmanuel Darcourt is the senior health director for the IRC. He spoke with me about what needs to be done for communities to take the lead in solving extreme challenges such as the Ebola epidemic.
There needs to be several things for communities to really take the lead in fighting against Ebola. The first is that we have to find a cadre of people who are good middle people, intermediaries between the communities and the international and government response. So you need to find people who really know how to approach communities and who generate trust and who understand how communities work and are able to quickly understand cues and reach out to people.
What would be some examples of these types of people that you all are working with now in communities?
Some of them are working for NGOs such as the IRC. Some of them are working for government, and some of them are working independently and like doing that. And some are men, some are women, some are actually quite shy, some of them are very much public figures, very comfortable in their role. That's a lot of very different kind of people. But what they have in common is that they are good listeners, and they're not thinking primarily about themselves. They have a real respect and understanding of just how powerful communities are and how able they are. So that rather than viewing them as sort of victims and as people who have little education or who are isolated from the world, they view them as incredibly effective people. And that's a hard thing to learn, that understanding of communities as powerful, effective entities rather than victims. So a characteristic of effective community workers is that they are able to deliver so that the community sees that this communication, this partnership they're having, is actually going to come through for them.
You've explained how important it is to really be a good listener as a community leader and to be able to take action after listening. How can this quality be used between communities, communities interacting with each other?
Well, very, very important. I think a big part of it is, in terms of applying it and spreading that, is that it can't be completely improvised. We've found that the people who do this best are people who have been doing it for 10, 15, 20 years. Often you'll find that the people who are doing best and who are doing the best work in Ebola have actually been doing good work for a long time and have long understood how communities are working.
Your organization has pledged $500,000 for community empowerment in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. How will this money be used?
We're going to use this money in a variety of ways, but principally we are going to use it to develop a group of people in Liberia as well as in Sierra Leone who are already doing work, and we're going to make sure that they have the resources they need to do that work better. So we're not going to invent a new infrastructure or have people come in cold who've never done this kind of work, and then we're suddenly going to train them. We're going to find the people who are already doing this work, and we are already doing that. So we're finding the people who do this work and making sure that they have the logistical support so that, for example, if they need a car or a motorcycle to take them from one village to another, they have that car or that motorcycle. If they need, you know, something as simple as, you know, a few sodas, because that's a part of holding a meeting, of when you call a meeting in West Africa, you have to provide just a few refreshments or a little food for participants, and that they're able to do that. These sound like such simple things, but these are the complaints we've been hearing from people. People have been doing the best work against Ebola that they don't even have the most basic support. We're also going to make sure they have things like rain gear so that, you know, as they do this work in the tail end of the rainy season, they don't have to be held back by simple material things like that. But the important thing for us is that we're not just committing these $500,000. We have tens of millions of dollars that we're dedicating to the fight against Ebola. And every one of those dollars is spent with the community in mind.
That was Emmanuel Darcourt, the Senior Health Director for the IRC. He spoke with me from New York City.
Today is Human Rights Day. This year's theme is Human Rights 365 to signify that every day is Human Rights Day. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says human rights are for everyone, no matter their class, opinions, or sexual orientation. He added that violations of rights are more than personal tragedies. They are alarm bells that may warn of a much bigger crisis. On this Human Rights Day, the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded. Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai and Indian child rights advocate Kailash Satyarthi made history today as they accepted this year's Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Oslo, Norway. 17-year-old Malala is the youngest Nobel laureate, while Satyarthi is the first Indian-born Peace Prize winner. The two are splitting the award's $1.1 million prize. Satyarthi said his aim in life is for every child to be free to be a child, adding, "There is no greater violence than to deny the dreams of children." Malala has dedicated her life to promoting girls' rights to education. She was shot in the head by the Taliban on her school bus in 2012.
Twenty minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. UN agencies have released a joint report today called the Global Status Report on Violence Prevention. It says homicide is the third leading cause of death for males between the ages of 15 and 44. It also says one in four children has been physically abused and one in three women has been the victim of physical violence. Dr. Etienne Krug is director of the Department for Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Disability, Violence, and Injury Prevention at the World Health Organization. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Well, we've just finished a big study looking at violence prevention efforts around the world. We've sent a questionnaire out to all countries, really, and 103 countries responded, representing 80% of the world population. What it shows is that there's still 470,000 homicides around the world every year. This is actually a decrease from the year 2000 by 16%, and an even bigger decrease in high-income countries. It's about almost 40%. However, we also looked at violence prevention programs around the world, and what we find is that, you know, we know what the best buys are, we know what works, but only one-third of countries are implementing large-scale initiatives to prevent violence, such as, you know, programs in schools to prevent bullying, programs to prevent the child maltreatment by having nurses visit houses, etc. Another piece of information we looked at is the existence of laws, and we looked at 12 key laws, which we found that most countries actually have them. However, they also report that they're not really being enacted, they're not really being implemented.
What's been the impact on women and children?
The impact on women and children is very big. We know that one in three women around the world are victims of violence by their partner or by strangers in terms of sexual violence. We know that one in four children around the world has been physically abused. That means already a huge proportion of the population. Violence, of course, we know causes injuries and deaths and disability. But it also has a very big impact on mental health. It has a big impact on sexual and reproductive health by, you know, transmission of HIV or unwanted pregnancies after rape. And it does change people's behavior. We know that people affected by violence are more likely to smoke, to abuse drugs and alcohol, to take on risky behaviors such as unsafe sex or unsafe driving. All of these have their own long-term consequences on health. So a large number of population is affected by violence, and the consequences on their health is huge.
Now, if so many countries have these laws in effect, any idea why so few are actually fully enforcing them?
Well, it's not always easy to enforce such laws, but there's also very often still tolerance around violence against women, tolerance around violence against children, and that's something we definitely have to change.
And how do you go about doing that in those countries?
I think we need to change our mindset and talk about it very openly and make sure that violence is considered as unacceptable, violence against any type of person, boys or girls, young or old. Because another finding of the report is that elder maltreatment is often one of the most neglected areas of violence. And we know that a large number of older people report having been abused. So it's a question of really changing the mindset and deciding violence is unacceptable. We're going to invest into preventing it by all possible means.
That's Dr. Etienne Krug. He's director of the Department for Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Disability, Violence, and Injury Prevention at the World Health Organization. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
A new study finds that South Africa's path to racial and social reconciliation is not only a long one, but one with several unexpected twists and turns. This year's report from the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation shows reconciliation is happening, but warned of the danger of forgetting the nation's racist past. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to the report's lead author and has the story from Johannesburg.
The Institute for Justice and Reconciliation says South Africans are more often blurring race lines when it comes to trusting their fellow man, 20 years after the end of the racist system of apartheid. The report finds trust between South Africans of different races has consistently risen in the past decade. That is illustrated by the discovery that black South Africans trust their political leaders, who are usually also black, less than ever. That sentiment is no doubt bolstered by a seemingly never-ending procession of high-level corruption scandals. But IJC project leader Kim Whale says not all the news is positive, and research shows that in 2013, South Africans are about 10% less likely to agree that apartheid was a crime against humanity than they were just a decade earlier. The 2002 treaty establishing the International Criminal Court classified apartheid a crime against humanity. That loss of awareness of a widely held truth, she says, should be a concern.
It's worrying because if we don't keep this memory alive, then we won't be tuned into addressing its legacy in the present, and unfortunately its legacy still really does remain with us.
She is referring to the wide economic disparities that still fall along race lines. The divisions are easy to see even to a casual observer in Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub. On one street corner in a trendy neighborhood filled with hip coffee shops, bookstores, restaurants, and patrons of all races, VOA News finds race is still a sensitive topic. Many passersby refuse to share their views on race. Others ask that we stick to their first names only. Leslie, a 23-year-old black man, works on the streets sometimes as a car guard. The rest of the time, he says, he is unemployed. But he does not see his situation as a legacy of apartheid and does not really remember it. When asked about the nation's historical inequalities, he came up blank.
1994, 1999, I was in grade one. So you see, my brain was not older to remember some things that they've been past.
Animator Paul Meyer, who is 40 and has three adopted children of a different race, says he is trying to raise his children in a land of equality and opportunity. But he says reconciliation is not happening everywhere.
I think it's a mixed bag, and I think you'll get different answers depending on who you speak to. I think there's definitely movement in both directions.
Bula Molefe, a 41-year-old domestic worker, said she thinks part of the divisions are caused by the inability of the government to crack down on crime.
What's stopping us is that we didn't reconcile yet. And we can't forgive each other. And there is a lot of things that are happening now that makes us angry each and every day, like corruption and robbery and stealing, all those things.
The IJC report says the nation's poor, who are almost all black, have been largely excluded from racial integration. Even the simple opportunity to socialize with people of other races narrows as income levels decrease. Well, says South Africans need to tear down their walls. First, the psychological ones, and then maybe some actual ones that abound around homes and buildings as part of extensive security measures in a crime-laden country.
So building awareness is the first step, and then there's structural transformation which requires the fact that South Africa still often looks very similarly to how it used to look during apartheid is a problem, and we need to readdress the way our cities are structured so that the poor are excluded and the poor remain black. So there are real structural changes that are required, but then also changes in terms of how ordinary South Africans understand racism and the operation of racism in society.
But she says South Africa has come a long way in just 20 years, though it has a long way to go. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis. We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.